Welcome to the very first in my series of nostalgia interviews. My name is Chris Deasy, and in the course of the following podcasts, you will hear a different person each week talking about their life and career. Nostalgia is the theme that binds it all together, and my very first guest is Dr. David Walsh, an archaeologist at the University of Kent. David used to present a radio program when he was a student at Reading, and he runs a podcast himself. In this interview, David speaks very freely about his earliest memories. We learn about the music he grew up with. We find out what it was that inspired him to become an archaeologist. And you might find that dinosaurs had something to do with that. His political dispositions are revealed. And we also learn that when it comes to interactive gaming, David has a very competitive side. This interview covers the Spice Girls, Bryan Adams, Bobby Kennedy, Jeremy Corbyn. And we find out whether David feels that he has yet, at any rate, fulfilled the dreams he had when he was young. So please join me for the first in my series of nostalgia interviews. My name is Chris Deasy. My guest is Dr. David Walsh. So we are ready to go. This is the very first of the nostalgia interview. So, David, you are the guinea pig.
Yeah.
But
the good news is the quality of guests will probably only go up from here.
I don't know. I think this might be the peak. So we shall see. But delighted that you were keen to do this. And actually, I want to talk in a minute about your background in university radio, which was something that I wish I had done 20 odd years ago. So in Reading, you were telling me about that last week. But so I'm Chris Deasy, and I'm interviewing David Walsh, and you can tell me a bit about yourself in a minute. But this is the first of our nostalgia interviews, so lots of questions which hopefully will in a way drawing on things that happened to you when you were a bit younger than me. So maybe it's the fairly recent past, but in my case, the reason, to be honest, that I'm keen to undertake these interviews is because I've reconnected with a lot of friends on social media that I'd wished for years I'd kept in contact with, and for various personal reasons fell out of contact with. And my present research is on nostalgia, and for me, going back to some of those programs, the radio programs especially, the films, which I can now watch in spanking great, you know, high definition, that I watched in those days, has a particular appeal. And I'm trying to work through, both academically and personally, what it is about the past and my past and my take on the past that is so personally sort of, you know, satisfying and indeed bittersweet. But tell me a bit about yourself.
Well, I will currently lecture here at the University of Kent in classical and archaeology studies. Kind of more down the archaeology end of the spectrum than on the classics end.
We were having that conversation last week about how different universities configure the relationship between archaeology and classics differently, or is it some departments have? Is it ancient history?
Yeah. I mean, in other universities, like when I was an undergraduate at Reading, classics and archaeology are two very separate departments. They inhabit not completely different worlds, but they are very much separate entities. So here at Kent, it's a bit different in terms of having that mixture within one department, which I do actually think is probably a good thing. I think there's an argument to be had that sometimes we lack the cross kind of interdisciplinary, the dialogue that maybe should be going on that doesn't happen so much between ancient historians, classicists, and archaeologists. There is the whole kind of argument that there's a famous quote by an archaeologist who said you should ask archaeology questions of the archaeology and history questions of the history. And when one tries to kind of bring them together, it doesn't always quite work. But even still, I think obviously the historical side of things provides context to what you do in archaeology. And from my perspective, I suppose, because my undergraduate being in ancient history and archaeology, I kind of started out more on the ancient history side of things and then drifted more into the archaeology side of things. Because when I was younger, I was very much like history was my favourite subject. It's always been the case. I mean, I always wanted to do archaeology, but the history was for some reason, history was something that always for me just completely clicked. I've never struggled with it as a subject. Things like biology or maths or something are completely different. It's a catastrophe. Well, not that bad, but still. The history side of things just, in my mind, just always sticks.
No, it was similar for me because I did my degree in theology, but I'm now teaching on a religious studies program in a department of theology and religious studies. But throughout my career, I've been labelled in different ways. I mean, at one point in one job I had, because I was teaching a module on religion and film, and I suppose that was the title of my PhD, somebody said, oh, he's obviously religious studies, so we'll allocate him religious studies rather than theology students, you know, for tutorials. Mm. So you do get that labelling, and certainly in one job I had, the theologians were on one floor, the religious studies people on the other, and there was this kind of, not so much a hierarchy, but a sense that, you know, whether you were in with the in crowd or the out crowd, you know, depended on which corridor you were in. I'm not going to say which one was which, but so you do have those sort of disciplinary perspectives, and sometimes I suppose it's because people are working in sort of different but sufficiently similar areas that they sort of know the same people, that sometimes it can be a bit, it either can be really incestuous, or sometimes there's that sense of wanting to show that you are doing something really different and distinctive, and you kind of want to sort of ensure that nobody is treading on your territory. And so you do find those sort of disciplinary conventions, and sometimes people have, and I get the sense of what you're saying in your subject particularly, there's that clear sense that you are a classicist or an archaeologist, and you're brought together like a coalition, I suppose.
Yeah,
a coalition government, you know. you work together strategically, but well, yeah, yeah, and you have to do, you know, more than 5 years. Yeah, no, absolutely. But tell me a bit. So you went to Reading, and tell me a bit about your background, where you grew up, where you're from, what your parents did.
Okay, I grew up at a place called Welling, which is kind of southeast London. There's kind of an ongoing debate as to whether or not it is Southeast London or Northwest Kent. I would say now it is very much Southeast London. If you went back probably about 30, 40 years, then it would be more Northwest Kent. But as London expands and engulfs everything around it, I would say probably my upbringing gravitated much more towards London than it did towards Kent. Very kind of urbanised area, or I suppose more suburbanised area. Lots and lots and lots of houses near a main high street. I grew up there, spent a lot of time, I suppose, going to a lot of museums in London, which had a big impact on me as a child and adolescent. My parents, my mum originally was a florist, but then once she had me, she kind of just went into part-time work, and she spent most of the rest of her time just working at school, mainly as a kind of dinner lady, after school club, that sort of thing. And my dad's pretty much just always worked for the Royal Mail. So neither of my parents, if I was the first one in my family to ever go to university. Nobody in my family had ever gone before. Although that's not to say that there weren't people in my family capable of doing so. Obviously, like, parents and also grandparents as well. I do have some very smart people in my family, or very able people in my family, is a better way of putting it. But they, obviously, you know, it was different time, different place, and they didn't necessarily always have the opportunity, which I'm quite lucky in the sense that, I mean, first of all, I'm an only child, so kind of my parents are kind of able to focus on me. But also, I think my parents are always very keen that I kind of make the most of the opportunities that I got. And obviously to work hard and try and progress. And this idea of going to university, doing something that I never did, which is, I suppose, not to say that they ever pushed me towards it. It's just been a natural thing. Because for me, as far back as I can remember, well, I say that's kind of a lie to say that I always wanted to be an archaeologist. I think I'm kind of similar to most archaeologists in the sense that I started off wanting to be a paleontologist and dig up dinosaurs when I was about 5. I think most archaeologists probably are slightly frustrated paleontologists, because you realise after a short while, you're like, oh man, I've got to spend a lot of time just studying rocks, just basic rock, like lots of geology and things like that, which I was like, oh, I've got no interest in. I just want to dig up dinosaurs. But then I kind of, as I progressed a bit further, I sort of switched my attention more towards human history, and that became my kind of desired path.
You just made me think, I don't know how old you are, but it may show the difference between us generationally, because people of my generation, I was born in 73, grew up with Indiana Jones, and so that sense of being an archaeologist, in a film that I just saw the other day, Life of the Party, it's the idea of, you know, you go into archaeology because you want to dig up the past, and find those dinosaurs, or in your case, but I'm guessing that Jurassic Park was probably more your generation.
I remember going to see Jurassic Park in the cinema, actually. I was terrified of it at the time. But that was like the greatest thing that ever happened at that time. Like for me, like Jurassic, like seeing the dinosaurs on screen was just incredible. I suppose when I think about it now, that probably that must have come out when I was really, really young. So it probably did have quite a strong effect on me at the time, although I was into dinosaurs before that. I mean, I say growing up, going to museums a lot. I remember the main museum we used to go to a lot when I was younger was the Natural History Museum. I spent a lot of time going around the dinosaur park. It wasn't until later in life that I started to appreciate maybe like the British Museum a bit more. Yeah. But that was a lot of weekends spent going around the Natural History Museum and other museums as well, but that was just for me, dinosaurs was the big thing.
And actually dinosaur was one of the first words that I've got twin sons, and we went to the Wingham Wildlife Park, and they have a cosmetic dinosaur, you know, one made out of flowers or whatever it was, as you arrive. And I could see one of my sons pointing, and it was a dinosaur. And I thought, how do you know the word? Because it was Peppa Pig. Because George and Peppa Pig, which made me... I know far more about Peppa Pig than I care to. But, George, who's Peppa Pig's brother, has a toy dinosaur. And actually, it worked in terms of my own children, in terms of their vocabulary.
Yeah.
You know, they recognise a dinosaur, even though, obviously, they're not going to encounter one in the garden or in the street. But for them, it's a real and a meaningful concept, and their vocabulary in some ways has been sort of born out of, you know, what they're watching on television. So I can see how Jurassic Park would completely have appealed to that, you know, paleontology side of you that you've sort of evolved with. What about very earliest memories? What can you remember? It sounds like we may have just touched on some of that.
I don't know really. I sort of have vague memories of being preschool. I remember that was in the Salvation Army hall, not too far from my house. I kind of vaguely remember Christmases, I suppose. I think Christmases probably are some of the strongest early memories, because I suppose that Christmas is obviously quite an emotive time, and when you're a kid you're just massively excited because you're going to get lots of toys. So that's probably why it stuck. Probably that and going on holiday as well, those sort of things as well. It's hard to sort of decipher what kind of order those memories are in, I would say. I couldn't tell you sometimes if something happened before something else or which way around it was. It's kind of just flashes of kind of different images, I suppose, of those sorts of things. I do have some sort of vague memories of probably my earliest days at school, but to be honest... even the whole of primary school now, I can sort of pick out individual bits and pieces, but then a lot of it just completely sort of falls into darkness. Yeah.
I went back the other week to Cardiff to the street, literally the streets where I grew up, and I found that all these places that were a taboo back in those days, when your parents would say, oh, you're not allowed to go further than so-and-so street, in those days it felt like a mile away. And of course, if you're really young, I suppose a few yards feels equivalent of a mile by today's standards. And it really surprised me, first of all, how close and hemmed in everything seemed compared to my small self experienced. But also that sense of almost regressing to that four-year-old self. And I almost imagined, because I had to think, oh, that's where so-and-so used to live. And I almost imagined if I knocked on that door, my friend Christopher's mother would answer, she said, are you here to play with Christopher, and we go and play. And it's really funny, but that was all evoked just by going back to those streets. And certainly I've got very powerful memories of going to nursery and digging in the garden, the sand pits, and particular music, actually, which they used to play. What they used to do at the end of the day would put on a record for us, like Pinky and Perky. And I was so obsessed by this, and if they didn't play it I would be really upset and wouldn't want to go home. So at the end of nursery they gave me the record. My parents have still got it, of Pinky and Perky, not In the Summertime, that's the Mongo Jerry song, but some sort of early 70s cover version with the squeaky voices. The Pushbike song, that was it. And it's funny, so for me that's really sort of grounded me, you know. And even now, that, you know, just, I very rarely hear Pinky and Perky, but it does completely conjure up this sense of growing up at a certain point and sort of navigating your way in an adult world, you know, being dependent on those adults playing those songs. Speaking of music, do you have any particular recollection of, I mean, for me, the charts were really foundational, even to the point of Sundays, certainly when I was in my teens, writing down the charts every Sunday, seeing what was number one, sharing it with my friends in school the next day, like, oh, well, my record went up 14 places, your favourite went down three, you know. But were there any particular, do you have any memories of what was in the charts around the time you were growing up, or...
There's a lot of stuff that I remember from the 90s. I was in primary school and the Spice Girls were at their peak, so that is something that I remember. And I suppose throughout most of my primary school, it was in the 90s. And actually, we haven't been in a while, but last year, a couple of times, me and my friends went to a 90s club in London, which was fantastic. I mean, it's crazy because you start to realise that a lot of that stuff... First of all, you realise there was a lot of good music in the 90s. Well, I suppose that's very subjective, but there was some incredible stuff. I mean, like Oasis, Blur, etc. as well. And, the 90s was... I mean, this is going to sound like a dumb thing to say, I suppose, but it's a long time in terms of music. Like, at the very start of the 90s, you still kind of got the... almost the overhang of things like hair metal bands. And then you had, like, Nirvana come along. And then you have Oasis and Blur. And then you have towards the end... Then you have the Spice Girls. And then towards the end of it was when Eminem was really starting to pick up. Like, there was a tremendous... I think it was like the late 90s anyway, the very end of the 90s that Eminem kind of first exploded onto the scene. But what I found with that was, it's just crazy because you realise how much that stuff is almost, it's almost kind of like it's in your DNA. Like, you don't even realise, like, how not even just like, it's not even like, oh, I know this song, it's like, I know a lot of the lyrics to this song as well. And you're almost like, I don't even know how. But I guess when I was younger, like most people when I was younger, a lot of that stuff was just on repeat and just on TV, on the radio, and it just, you just subliminally almost pick it up. And
yeah, it's quality proof. I mean, I find that listening to the nostalgia programmes on the radio, like Sounds of the 80s, because it sounds like I'm a generation older than you. And so for me, I mean, you're quite right. I mean, in the 80s, you'd have like the Human League and Adam and the Ants right at the beginning of the decade. And by the end, you'd have the Happy Mondays. And And in the 90s, actually, for me, 90s was a decade for film. I discovered film when I went to university, and I lost interest in music. Yeah. But at the very beginning, I mean, the Bryan Adams song that was number one for, like, you know, well, 16 weeks, but it felt like 16 years. That was right at the beginning. And then by the... from the Robin Hood movie.
On a slight tangent to that, when I was a teenager, talking of nostalgia, when I was about 16, 17... me and my friends used to go to a pub not too far from where we lived in Sidcup, called the Blue Rose, which I don't think is there anymore now, actually. But obviously, being that age, I shouldn't have really been in the pub. None of us really should have been in there. But what it was because they used to have karaoke every Thursday night, and nobody would ever do karaoke apart from us. So they kind of seemed to give us a little bit of leeway on that, where we used to go there. And every week, without fail, we would go there on a Thursday night, and my friend would always sing Summer of 69 by Bryan Adams. That big band, that's always become like, that's one of those songs now that we can't really have a big event without it being played with us all around. But that's, it kind of, everybody's like, oh yeah, this song. It's something you can see, it kind of sets off in everybody's head. They sort of have that memory.
And interestingly, that Radio 2 have just changed some of their schedules. And I noticed that there was a discussion yesterday, what would be the first song played on the new Drive Time programme? And it was Bruce Springsteen, Dancing in the Dark. And that's the second time I've heard that on the radio in the last week. Another programme that started the Midnight Show, the first song was Gloria by Laura Branigan. So again, for me, huge 80s, sort of, big numbers. And I think generationally, I think it's clearly saying, I mean, I grew up listening to Radio 2 in the early 90s when I was a student. It was all sort of late 50s, early 60s. It was almost like stepping into my parents, if not actually my grandparents' generation. You know, Bobby V, Matt Monro, Roger Whittaker, Helen Shapiro. And now it's the music very much sort of, you know, rock music, the sort of the stuff that's really cool and always has been cool and always will be. No, that's interesting. But yes, but for me, the early 90s was just that sort of time around when the New Kids on the Block started to become really big, and I thought somehow I'd moved on from that. I didn't connect with that. It felt for me as though somehow contemporary music had run its course, and I think for me, I just started listening to a lot of older stuff from around that period.
That happens with a lot of people, though, because that happened with me probably, I would say, probably about five or six years ago. I hit a point where I'd say I still kind of listen to new music, but it's kind of a sense of I listen to a much wider range than I used to. I mean, when I was a teenager, when I was in secondary school, even growing up, for the most part, up until probably around about the age of 14, I'd say, I wasn't really that fussed about music. It didn't really have much of a big kind of impact on my life. I liked certain things. But I remember round about that sort of age where I met quite a lot of people who are quite good friends of mine now. I've been very good friends for a number of years. And a number of them were really into their kind of rock music. They really liked Green Day, Blink 182, these sort of bands. And also a guy I ended up seeing next to in, I think it was English class, also had a Blink 182 album that he just didn't really want anymore. And he was like, "Do you want it?" And I was like, "All right then." And that kind of just set me off. And that kind of genre of music, that what I suppose tends to be labelled as pop punk, but kind of also varying out into kind of a lot more rock music and also older punk like the Pistols and the Clash and things like that. I was kind of, you kind of, when you're a teenager as well, that was like, I found my tribe kind of sort of sense. And that was when I was like, this is my music. That's what I listen to. And it wasn't until probably at the end of my teenage years that I remember having this decisive moment where I sort of started listening to a lot wider range of music, because I remember being in the shower in my undergraduate uni house with the radio on and a Coldplay song came on. And up to that point, I was like, I hate Coldplay. Coldplay are terrible, because they were like, they seemed like the antithesis of what I listened to. And it was a song, Viva La Vida. And I was like, man, this is a really good song. And then I was just like, okay, that's it, game over now. I might as well just accept it and not, you know, listen to pretty much, well, not listen to everything, but kind of be willing to give everything at least a go. And suddenly I realised, actually, I like quite a wide range of music. But probably a few years after that was where I sort of stopped being into that kind of, even now, if Blink 182 or Green Day or whoever brings out a new album, I'll listen to it. But there was a time when I was a teenager where I would listen to every kind of almost new band that was appearing out of that kind of genre of music. And they kind of hit a point where I just kind of almost stopped with that, because it was just, it wasn't really speaking to me anymore. Yeah. Because it wasn't really, I don't know, like, I guess you move past that point of that kind of music was speaking to you at a certain moment in time, and then you've kind of moved past that moment, so you start to find other music, and you almost, yeah, I can't really explain it so much. You connect with other types of music, and you become less kind of tribal, I guess, about your music.
There is something, it does feel like saturation, but I always remember Annie Nightingale, who I think is still on Radio 1, and she's well into her 70s now, and she's been there since 1970, and she's only interested in new music, which is why she's still on Radio 1 at her age. But I've gone the opposite way. I mean, in my case, I've got children who are all, you know, my eldest is 6, and I really have no idea what was out, you know, what was number one in the charts when they were born. Really no interest. But for me, growing up, particularly in the 80s, you know, it kind of mattered a lot of this sort of the big seismic, and also the minor, like, you know, first day at school, or, you know, events, world events or personal events. I often associate with, you know, music that I was listening to at the time, the stuff that was on the radio in the morning while getting ready for school. And, you know, those are the things that we talked about in the playground. I kind of feel that's missing now. I think the charts particularly, it was very much a sense of, you know, how we identified ourselves as we were growing up through adolescence, the musical interest that we had, the way in which actually it was a really big conversational point, and it was something sort of external that we were all tapping into. And in the days before social media, it kind of had a much bigger power. I mean, actually, even lunchtime, the charts used to come out at Tuesday lunchtime. So when I was sort of 12, 13, people would bring their transistor radios to school, and at 12:45 we'd wait for the countdown to see what was number one that week before the charts were released on a Sunday. And that was a big thing. And also, like, the cool people would sit round and listen, whereas, you know, everybody else would be playing football or not interested at all. But, you know, it was one of those moments of almost a sort of like communitas. It was a real sense, it was something liminal almost, that, you know, listening to this on a Tuesday said something about our value system, and it was much more than the pop charts. There was a real sense of identity, and we all came together, and then we'd disperse afterwards and go back to our lessons, and, you know, the different years would all sort of come together. But but you mentioned obviously about university. I mean, what inspired you to enter academia?
I think from my perspective, I've never really thought of myself first and foremost as being an academic. First and foremost, I'm an archaeologist. That is how I would identify myself. I don't know if I see myself forever being in academia. I certainly see myself always doing something to do with history or archaeology. But I kind of... I suppose when I was an undergraadjuate, I didn't give it much thought. I mean, I knew I wanted to be an archaeologist, but I wasn't the best of undergraadjates. I wasn't bad. I was good. That was kind of the problem. I kind of knew I was good, so I didn't push myself perhaps as much as I should have done. I played far too much time. Not far too much time, but more time than I should have done playing FIFA and doing things like that. Although I still think I'm the best at it. It wasn't until I was probably at the end of my third year of undergraduate, I knew I wanted to be an archaeologist, and I went to Amanda Clark, who is at the time was the assistant director of Silchester, which was the biggest excavation in the country, and it was Reading's excavation at Roman town. It's never been built over, and people used to go there every year to sort of gain experience in field work. And I went to Amanda, who is perhaps one of the most loveliest people you will ever meet, and she was like, okay, so there's a thing called Grampus Heritage where you could go on that and you could go abroad for a couple of months, which in my case I ended up going to Cyprus for 2 months to dig there at a 6th century Christian basilica, which was fantastic. I mean, the mosaics were still in situ. They had like a tomb of the priests that was still there. And she also got me onto a dig, which was being run by another member of staff there, Gabor, which was actually down here in Kent at Leminge, which was an Anglo-Saxon site as well. But I went to those, and I in both those situations I met somebody, and I was chatting to them, and they were like, you know, you should really look at going into doing the MA in Roman archaeology at Leicester. You sound like you'd really, really be up for that. And I was like, well, if two different people have said that to me in completely different contexts, I was like, maybe I should. So I ended up going. I came back from those after and just spent some time working full-time, and ended up going to do the MA. And I think the MA was kind of a big turning point for me. That was where I sort of really started stepping up in terms of my understanding of archaeology, of Roman archaeology, and understanding that I got to the end of it, and I was like, I would really want to do a PhD now. And I knew what I wanted to do a PhD on. I had a very clear idea of that. I didn't do it immediately. I ended up taking another year out where I actually worked in commercial for a while, commercial archaeology, digging Monday to Friday. But I suppose the MA, like, starting to get hold of subjects and really starting to get to grips with them, and I don't know, like, the idea of that whole thing of putting a puzzle together, almost doing the research and producing an argument, I started to really fall in love with more than I'd done so when I was probably an undergraduate. And I just really enjoyed it, and I just, yeah, and it's going to be one of those things that I just haven't stopped really. It's just kind of kept going.
No, I think the analogy of a jigsaw is a really good one, and when I'm meeting my students for their dissertation projects, I liken it to a jigsaw, that sometimes you know what the jigsaw is supposed to look like, but you either do or don't have all the pieces, or you may have some of the pieces, or maybe sometimes you can't be bothered to put them together, or sometimes you're sort of a bit lazy and you think, well, you know, I don't think I put them in quite the right place. But yeah, and I think that a PhD is a bit like that, in terms of the way that it can be quite satisfying. I've got no interest in jigsaws, interestingly, but I do think that a PhD and writing a book, when you're bringing together all the different resources, the satisfaction that you get when it all, at the end of the process, falls into place, you know, that is a real skill. And of course, it's like equivalent. If every word of a PhD is, you know, a jigsaw piece, then you're talking 100,000, piece jigsaw, which probably would take, you know, someone rather a few months, rather years to accomplish. So, there's a certain mindset, I think, that a project that can be deeply satisfying, but also, certainly in my case, once I embarked on the PhD, you know, there was no going back. It sort of met a particular need in me to accomplish something. And putting order and assimilating a disparate body of material, because I suppose working in religious studies, we deal with paradox, and work that I do in religion and film, how do they come together? Or Christmas and religion, and, you know, exploring the interface between the religious and the secular. So, yeah, I can see your motivation there. But were there particular teachers, lecturers who inspired you, or particular friends or colleagues who made you think, yeah, this is, I want to be like them?
There's been a lot of people, I suppose, over the years. I mean, I mentioned Amanda at Reading, who I say is great. I always say this about undergraduate. I mean, I mentioned earlier about the fact that I know I could have done better undergraduate if I spent less time playing FIFA and less time winning at FIFA. But if anyone asked me, like, do I have a regret for undergraduate, I would say the only thing there was probably that I did a module in my third year on Roman Britain with Hella Eckhart, and Hella is great. She actually won Archaeologist of the Year last year, which she gets a little bit embarrassed about when you mention it, but she's one of those people that her enthusiasm is just fantastic, and I look back on that now and I really wish I'd taken more advantage of it at the time. I mean, it's worked out okay, but looking back, she was one of those people where you just think, wow, she was really, really great teacher, and I didn't put the effort in from the student side that I should have done. I could have got more out of that, I think. But Hella and Amanda, certainly when I was at Reading, and when I went to do my MA, there was a number of people there. I clicked at Leicester. I clicked really well with Neil Christie, because Neil did the module there on the MA module there on early Christian Europe, which essentially was like the end of the Roman Empire and the successor kingdoms that come out of it, kind of with a particular emphasis on religion as well, and that ended up being something that's run through. That was something I really excelled in, something I really enjoyed doing, and that's kind of followed through into what I did for the PhD and what I do now, which is very, funny enough, is religion in the late Roman world. That's really my sort of focus of interest. So that having Neil as a teacher was a massive benefit, and he actually introduced me to Luke Levan here at Kent, who was my PhD supervisor. And Luke, he's been one of those people that just, ever since I've met him, I don't know the best way of describing Luke. I mean that in a good way. He's one of those people that he and I came together, and it's almost been a situation of almost perfect synergy. Not perfect, actually. Perfect's the wrong way of saying it. Certainly far from perfect stuff. But he's one of those people that, as a PhD supervisor, he was able to get me some funding, which I was immensely grateful for. So straight away, I was put into work tremendously hard for him. But he was quite demanding, and at times it would almost be like taking it a bit too far. But the thing was that I was very, by this point, I was very focused. As I say, I was very grateful to getting the funding, so I just kind of went at it, and we went at it. And he ended up producing a very good PhD, which is hopefully published in the not-too-distant future. He is now with the publishers. It should be in proof. I should get the proof anytime now, actually. But Luke's he's rigorous, kind of pushing me to keep going. That, I mean, I think that's what I needed as well. I think that kind of made a big difference. I think if I had a supervisor that had been much more hands-off and just been like, oh, you'll be fine, it's okay, you know, didn't really look over my shoulder so much, that it probably could have gone off the boil. But Luke sort of cracking the whip was probably something that I actually needed. And I think as a result, we actually managed to produce something that was great. On the flip side of things, actually, though, I think as well, it's quite an interesting thing in terms of inspiring. One of the things that I've found as well, though, with what I've done so far, is that I work quite well when people, I want to say doubt me, but people maybe question whether or not what I'm doing is the right thing, or critical of it. Basically, what I need is a sense sometimes to prove people wrong. I always remember there were two things said to me at Leicester at the end of my time there, which has stuck with me for a long time. One of them was from Neil, and Neil actually said to me towards the end, he was just like, we thought early on you were going to do really, really well, and he was like, you didn't quite get there in the end. Like, that kind of sense, he was like, you did fine, but we thought you were going to do really well, and it didn't quite get there. And that kind of was like, I was kind of like, okay, I'll take that, and went away and had that in the back of my mind. And David Mattingly, who's professor of Roman archaeology and kind of one of the most foremost Roman archaeologists there are, and David is a lovely, lovely person as well, but David said to me, we had a conversation as well towards the end of the MA, where David said to me, I said that I was thinking about doing a PhD on the cult of Mithras. That's something, a subject I think there was more to look at, stuff to explore. And he was like, no, I think everything's been written on the cult of Mithras. There's nothing else to really be said on this now. It's been done to death. I would, you know, he was like, I think you should go look at something else. And I was adamant that there was something to do there. So basically, those two phrases in my mind were playing round and round when I did the PhD on the cult of Mithras. And obviously I passed, and it's going to publish, so I would write.
I had a brilliant PhD supervisor, but he didn't ask for work to be handed in at certain times. Mm-hmm. He didn't say, right, can I have 3,000 words by next Thursday or something like that. So what I saw that as a challenge, and some people, I think, didn't like that, because if their supervisor is not asking them for work, they're not going to produce anything. But in my case, I felt, well, he's not asking me for work, but maybe that's his, you know, subliminally, there's a process going on here whereby he's really saying, well, I want you to do the work, but in your own time, it's part of the process, part of the discipline. And so what I would do is write without forewarning him, you know, 3,000 words or so. I'd bump in. This is the days before we had things like Moodle. So I would bump into him and say, oh, yeah, I've got my my latest chapter. And the look on his face was like, oh, right, well, thank you for that. But really, he's thinking, oh, I'm very busy at the moment. I thought, oh, no, I don't care when you read it. Just for me, I just need to know. I need you to know that I've done it.
Yeah.
And, you know, the ball is in your court. And I was just so satisfied that without being required to submit something, I was doing it. But it's a kind of like lateral thinking way of doing things. And I think for me, there's always that sense that somebody else has always got more publications. There's always a colleague who's written more. And in some cases, you say, well, yeah, of course, because they're 10 years older, and, you know, they got, and maybe they're always getting research grants. And, you know, I mean, I love being senior tutor, but sometimes I'm aware that I think, oh, I really need to get some writing done today. It doesn't always quite work out. But there is something satisfying when you can be autonomous.
Yeah.
And you can have a really good, as a PhD student, as I did with mine, have a really good working relationship, but kind of feel that you're always, there's always something that makes you feel that you're not complacent. And if you're given, you know, even if you're given really constructive criticism, that you don't then say, oh, well, I just, you know, coast along. You try even harder the next time. And I think that sometimes there are different strategies of making that work. If I'd had a supervisor who wanted to, as it were, crack the whip, I don't think I would have enjoyed that, because I would feel that I was sufficiently self-motivated. But it just depends. I think actually a really good supervisor is one who can adapt to the different personalities.
Yeah.
I think that's probably what mine was doing.
I think in my case, with Luke, it was kind of a case of he was quite big on quantity. I mean, nobody had ever looked at something where you took all the Mithraic temples across the entire Roman world, which is what I ended up doing. But the result of that was actually to have something in the end where I went into my advisor, and I talked to some people about this, and I know a number of people going to their PhD advisors feeling quite nervous, and obviously I was nervous, like, as anyone would be. But at the same time, I did have a kind of sense of, I was like, I've done everything here. I was like, there's nothing else I could have done here. Like, I've exhausted this to the nth degree. If it's not up to scratch, then I'm not going to feel bad, because I know that I did everything I could do.
The PhD can be the most cathartic thing, because you know that the person who's examining you has read the thesis, and you know that not very many people have, or maybe never will. I mean, if it's published, then that's a bit different. Maybe your own students, that's really quite satisfying.
I'm sure no one's going to read my stuff.
No, well, yeah, but I remember thinking at my Viva, well, this is my opportunity to talk with an audience where, no matter what I say, it's that they're tuned into, you know, they've read the thesis, they're going to understand me. For me, the worst thing, and I've said this to my students sometimes, you know, we can be talking about the death of God for 2 hours on a Thursday afternoon. I'll go to the supermarket afterwards to do some shopping, and the person at the checkout will say, oh, so what do you do then? You say, oh, I work at the university. Oh, what do you teach? And you're thinking, oh, where's this going? And you say, oh, religious studies. And suddenly the conversation moves into I had a real problem with the church when I was young, or whatever, or you're touching on a nerve. And I sometimes find in those situations I'm out of my depth. But in a Viva, I felt completely at home, because I knew that having written this thing for a few years, it was a pleasure to get it all out. The thought of just writing it and then somebody reading it and that being the end of it, there has to be a process almost. It is a ritual of sorts, I think, that you go through. And I think, like you, I was very apprehensive, and I was as far from complacent as you can be, but I also knew that they'd read the thesis. They'd probably made up their mind anyway. So I treated it as if my life depended on it. So as if every question was going to make all the difference to whether I got it or not.
Yeah.
I would subsequently learn that, I think, you know, they certainly knew. They put me through, you know, I think the examiner in my case had, let's say, 30 or 40 questions, and I was giving quite long answers to all of them, and I thought, oh, it's going on and on, and, you know, they're asking me more and more questions because they're not satisfied with the answers I'm giving. You know, if I'd given monosyllabic answers, it might have been over in 5 minutes, but I felt very satisfied that job done, and I knew that I was unlikely ever to find myself in a situation like that where you could talk so passionately with an audience of you know, people with fellow mindset. So it's very gratifying. So it sounds like your experience as well. But sounds like you had a good hinterland as well, because playing sports was obviously something that was important to you, or at least when you mentioned FIFA. Is that, tell me what that is.
Oh, FIFA's a computer game.
Yeah, exactly. I thought so, yeah.
I'm better with my hands playing in the computer game. It's gaming.
One of my PhD students has just finished on looking at games and religion. So, you know, absolutely. So sitting in front of a terminal, you know, can do all sorts of interactive type experiences.
Yeah, there's an ongoing rivalry I've had with one of my old housemates that's now gone on for probably over 10 years. In that regard, it doesn't seem... He lives in China now, but every time he comes back, it still doesn't show any chance of abating. We put one day aside whenever he comes back to sit there and just play FIFA. Absolutely. For a day. Yeah. I'm still better than he is. You can tell me, took your chips on my shoulder. Yeah. You can tell I'm on there. Yeah.
But I mean, for me, when I was an undergraduate, I voted for the very first time. It was the 1992 general election, and I was listening to a podcast just the other day, actually with George Osborne, who I always thought that, you know, he was somebody who was Chancellor of the Exchequer, and I heard a different side to him in this interview, because I just thought that he was somebody who, you know, he was posh, he went to a posh school, he came from a family of Tories, and, you know, in a way he, you know, followed a particular trajectory that seemed inevitable. But no, he was talking about how his mother was a Labour supporter who voted for Margaret Thatcher because she was a woman, his father was a Liberal, and his mother might have been, if her son hadn't already been in politics, might have been persuaded to vote Labour under Tony Blair. So, you know, I was surprised at that trajectory. And for him, he said, you know, the 92 election was between two different sort of visions, and for him there was no doubt that it was John Major's vision that was more appealing. For me, it was the other way around. I was very much, well, obviously this was before New Labour, but very much, you know, left wing. In your case, I'm not asking you to give away your politics, but did you find through the politics of the time, has that been a major influence on you? Did you vote at all when you were a student? Have you continued to cast your vote, you know, in the same sort of way? Has that been a particular inspirational or motivating force for you?
I think probably more recent years, especially with the current climate that we live in, I've become more interested in politics than I used to be. I've always... happy to say I've always been down the left end of the spectrum. When I was a bit younger, I would have voted Lib Dem, not so much anymore. although I still think they've got an appeal to some extent, but nowadays it tends to be, most of the time actually, I tend to vote Green. I don't know how much in terms of politics have an influence on my life, or vice versa, really. It's a case of my politics are influenced by my life, if that makes sense. I'm just one of those people that I don't know, I suppose it's always going to be a way, I think, predominantly in academia, everybody's a lot more left-leaning because of the fact that we're kind of more understanding of, I think we're moving towards a more globalised society. I don't think there's another avenue to take with that. I think you have to kind of accept the fact that the world is moving together, and I think you have to learn to be... I think this idea of trying to put up borders now is perhaps not going to work. I don't think it's the way forward. I understand why people do it, and I think that there's a lot of interesting things to be discussed about things like social media, and to what extent we all basically live in echo chambers where we're just like talking to people that essentially have the same view that we do, and we don't necessarily always get the other side of things. That's the problem nowadays. I think if there is one kind of big issue, I think it's this kind of polarisation between groups of people, and everyone sort of almost paints the opposite side as a caricature. It's almost like, you know, when you're talking to people on Twitter and stuff, people forget that there's like human beings at the other side that they're kind of demonising almost, and a lot of those people they're not that bad. Obviously there are very bad people, and there are people out there that have like really terrible views, but a lot of the time people are more just, you know, people are just concerned about things like their immediate families and their own kind of, you know, life, how their own life is going, that sort of thing. And I guess a lot of times people are just kind of scared, and they just kind of want to understand, they don't really quite understand what's going on. I mean, we're living in a world now that's changing at such a rapid pace, and I can understand why people want to put the brakes on it.
And I found this with Brexit here. Everybody I spoke to in the run-up to the referendum 2 years ago was in favour of remaining in the EU. And when the vote went, obviously, the other way, it made me see that there is almost an ivory tower nature of working in this profession.
Mm.
And, you know, if you're always surrounded by people who share the same, in many cases, as you rightly say, often left-wing sort of sensibilities, then you sometimes think, goodness, you know, I did not see that coming, if I'm honest, although I always thought the vote was going to be close. But although actually, if it had gone the other way around, I suspect, like in Scotland, when there was, you know, the SNP did amazingly after the referendum in Scotland didn't go their way. And I think here, you know, I think the demise of UKIP is largely because obviously the vote went the way that UKIP wanted it to. And I think UKIP would be in a very strong position. I think they'd have plenty of members of parliament if the referendum had gone the other way, and I think there would be calls almost daily for a second referendum.
Yeah.
So I think although the vote wasn't the way I wanted it to, I don't think it would have been the case. It would have been 52-48 in the other direction, that the job would have been done and we'd all be sighing, you know, with relief. But
yeah. I don't know, I just kind of feel like we're in a bit of a quagmire at the moment. I mean, I did vote Labour last time round. There's a lot of things that Jeremy Corbyn says that I do agree with, but I don't know, I've got to be honest with you, I do have a slight scepticism at the moment that he is ever going to get into power. It just kind of feels like we're just kind of, I don't know, there just feels like a kind of a sense at the moment, like, that we've not got really any of that kind of, there's nobody on the stage that, I mean, for all his faults, and he does have his faults, I'm not saying otherwise, but somebody like when Obama came along, there was that kind of sense of we're moving towards the future. Like, there was kind of a sense of, you know, somebody that could perhaps bring unity. I mean, obviously, this is not for our country, it's for America, but that kind of sense of, I don't want to say, like, younger is better, but that kind of vigour and determination, like, kind of bringing a new kind of style of leadership that's kind of perhaps a bit more optimistic. And it's quite interesting, actually. I've just finished on Netflix watching, there's a new four-part documentary that came out about Bobby Kennedy. That's really, really interesting. I mean, I know, you know, once again, the Kennedys are sort of people that you can't really, you know, they had a tremendous number of faults. But watching kind of the journey sort of chart, the first episode's about his up to the end of JFK's assassination, and then kind of Bobby Kennedy's sort of journey after that, and you sort of come to realise that perhaps he did really, I don't know, it comes across like, and I think a lot of people around believe the fact that he had an understanding of a lot of the issues in America, a lot of people from different ethnic backgrounds who he was very popular with in the end, because he seemed to really actually care genuinely about their kind of sense of what was going on, like the wrongs that were being done against them, and that kind of the that sense of like when he was assassinated, that they kind of, that he might have actually been somebody at the time to kind of really kind of start moving things forward, and that kind of sense of loss. And then obviously they elected Nixon instead, which, I mean, this is kind of benefit of hindsight, because I don't, most people who elected Nixon at the time probably didn't realise you would have Watergate and things like that, but that kind of, I don't know, just having that kind of person, that kind of sense of somebody who is a unifier as opposed to a divider, somebody who is going to, you know, bring people together and kind of have, I don't know, so it's a vision for the future, but kind of gives you a sense that, oh, we are actually progressing rather than regressing. And I think there's a lot at the moment in the sense of, I feel like, I don't think we're regressing so much, but I think we're kind of just stuck in a little rut, which is our pessimistic way of looking at it. But I also, given the fact that I do archaeology and history, I know that things go, not in cycles, but, you know, we go ups and downs, things will change again. It's a pendulum, like, you know, things I think you were at Shane's talk last night, yes, about Europe and the way people sort of approach Europe as an idea. And some, it was interesting, you know, people there talking about, we're going to have United States of Europe. And this was coming before World War One. Like, we're just, like, on the, they didn't realise they're on the verge of this massive catastrophe that was going to rock Europe for the next, well, I'd say half a century, but more than that. And how that's affected it. Things can change quite rapidly as well. So, that's not to say I think that we're stuck in a quagmire, but that we're going to be stuck there forever.
No, and I think that somebody said when Corbyn was elected that, oh, it's you know, it's back to the days in the Conservative Party when Ian Duncan Smith was elected. But I think there's a big difference. When Corbyn was elected, there was a real sense of surprise, a sense that this was somebody who just represented something very different from, certainly from New Labour, and certainly with all the gulf, you know, after what happened with the Iraq War, a sense that he was somebody who was passionate and full of integrity, but also the antithesis of leadership. He'd never sought a position in government or as a shadow minister, and here he was now leading a party. So there was a sense of starting with a fresh broom, but as you rightly say, perhaps living out some of the battles of the 1970s. But the difference is that, yeah, with some someone like Ian Duncan Smith, I think he was elected as leader of the Tory party because he wasn't Ken Clark. I think that in his case, it was not so much people thought he's the man to lead us. It's more his values are more in keeping with ours. And we know that we want to stop the other guy who has this charisma and this appeal. I think in Corbyn's case, he came along unexpectedly, even I'm sure to himself, you know, the right person at the right time. But yes, there are lots of enemies within his own party. Whether he'll make it into government, I don't know, because I mean, nobody would have thought that he'd still be leader after the election that we had. And of course, he's a more stable leader than we have with Theresa May, of course, who lost her majority. So yeah, watch this space, I think. But but that was the thing that struck me about Corbyn, that a lot of people got very excited. In a way that politicians had been up to that point much more of a turn-off, or people, you know, feeling that, you know, they're all saying the same thing, there's nothing distinctive, they're all inhabiting the middle ground, but it's all a bit wishy-washy. Whether you vote left or right, you kind of get the same variation of the same product. I mean, certainly 2010, Nick Clegg, David Cameron, and well, both Milibands were all the same age, really, and you couldn't. There wasn't really you couldn't put a cigarette paper sort of, as the same age between them.
And sort of
public school, or certainly two of them.
I think a lot of people have just have over the years just lost faith in politicians. I think they a friend of mine always says, you know, when a politician's lying because he opens his mouth. it is that kind of sense. I think a lot of people have become disillusioned with politics, which is quite a shame. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I feel slightly hypocritical saying that. I mean, I'm not really somebody to go canvassing door to door or anything, and sometimes I feel like I should be doing that for somebody like the Green Party, because the Green Party is kind of probably the closest you've got in terms of my own outlook to a political party, perhaps, as I say, I'm not too keen to put my money where my mouth is in terms of, well, I mean, it's just, you know, it's a case of things like time and stuff as well, obviously, but
what comes through in what you're saying, because we'll wrap up in a minute, but I'm getting the sense that you're quite a positive, forward-looking person. Would you say that you are?
Yeah, I suppose in terms of nostalgia, like linking it back to the subject matter, probably a lot of that's to do with things like growing up watching a lot of things like Star Wars and Star Trek and stuff, and I suppose you kind of, to me, I grew up with a lot of things like, I mean, I love the fact we have the Marvel movies at the moment, because I grew up with a lot of those characters as well, and I guess that kind of sense that you go through a bit of a rocky road, but things hopefully turn out in the end for the best. Even sometimes, I don't think sometimes you get to the best without sacrifices occurring. I think that's something that you have to be aware of, that sometimes for the greater good, things don't necessarily always go exactly the way you want them to. It's never a smooth road, but I think kind of growing up with that as part of it, I think, has kind of led me to sort of feel like, well, I think there are, I just get the impression that I think there are a lot of good people in the world. I think there are a lot of people who want to do the right thing as well, because obviously if I'm watching those kind of films and reading those kind of comic books and stuff, somebody's writing that and it's got a wide appeal, so there's a lot of people that must kind of feel along similar sort of lines to that. So yeah, I'm still hopeful. I'm not completely wrong. I mean, I think there's still time for us all to, like, kind of the human race to kind of move in the right direction. It's not game over just yet.
and on a personal level for yourself, would you say that you've fulfilled the dreams that you had when you were young? I mean, you said that you always wanted to do something in history, and you may not stay in academia, but something in archaeology or ancient history is a real appeal. But, you know, do you entertain thoughts about doing something different with your life that may be in keeping with what you dreamed about doing as a child or at university? I mean, for me, radio was always something I wanted to do, because ironically I'd now study radio as part of my academic work, and I guess even this podcast in a way is of me, you know, doing a radio show of what I grew up listening to 20 or 30 years ago. But would you say that you can imagine doing something very different in the future? Are there certain things that you wanted to be when you were very young that you still kind of hold out the hope that you might still, you know, whether it's walking on the moon or or finding those dinosaurs?
Yeah, I don't know, really. I've got to be honest. This is going to sound like a slightly, I don't know if it comes across as a slightly arrogant thing to say, but I'm kind of at a stage now where I can kind of look at what I've done so far, and I've got to be honest, like, I'm like done everything. Like, if you could take 5-year-old me and bring him here to now, his reaction would just be like, holy crap, like, this is incredible. Like, I never would have assumed, even when I was an undergraduate, to assume that I would now be a lecturer at university teaching archaeology, that I would have a book that's going to come out to have gone and dug in places like Cyprus. I mean, I went to Kosovo last year to dig, like get to see like places like around the world, and a lot of the time not have to really pay for it because I'm there, kind of I'm working, but I don't really still ever think of it as being a job. And I think it sounds cheesy when you think of it that way, but the idea of that, I still don't really think of what I do entirely as being a job. It's something that I would do regardless. I'd be reading those books about history if I wasn't doing this. I mean, even when I was going through my PhD, I had a part-time job at a garden centre, but I used to love just sitting on the chill, and I'd usually read like a history book, even if it wasn't directly linked to what I was doing. But I was still like there in that kind of time, even though that was great. I had a job that was away from academia, and that actually helped a lot. But I spent a lot of time in that job probably still reading about stuff to do with history, because I'm a little bit like, if I'm not doing that, it's weird to me to not be doing that. That's just what I do.
And it's very much the process, I think, as well, because obviously with a PhD, you can have the goal, the dream of accomplishing a particular goal and having that certificate, but it's working for it. It's the doing of it, I think, sometimes. The satisfaction that comes from whatever happens at the end of it, you know that you're doing something meaningful that is part of a process, that you're learning something about yourself. You know how to interrogate sources, primary, secondary. In your case, obviously, you are adding field trips onto that, which I certainly didn't do as part of my PhD, which was entirely theory-based. But, you know, there's that sense that whatever happens, you've put the effort into it and you've got something out of it at the other end. And it's not a job. I remember somebody once saying to me, yeah, but, you know, when you've retired, are you going to look back and think, I wish I'd gone to work more or done more work or worked harder? And in some ways I think, well, that's the difference maybe between a job and a vocation, because in my case, that need to push myself, and you know, you even get this with politicians, you know, why they're still members of parliament in their 70s and 80s, wouldn't they have, you know, gone on a long time ago? But no, because it's in their DNA. And I think that what you've said about academia is very sort of similar to my own experiences.
Yeah. I mean, I don't ever see myself entirely, assuming things carry on the way they are, I don't really ever see myself entirely retiring. I mean, I see myself retiring from being like a full-time lecturer, but I don't see myself ever there coming a day where I'd sit there and be like, I'm done with archaeology now. I'm like, I don't want to write articles anymore or write books anymore. I think, you know, as long as I'm still getting that great enthusiasm out of it, then that's something that I want to carry on doing. So hopefully that never goes away. Hopefully, like, touch wood, when I'm like 90 odd, it'll still be there.
David Walsh, thank you.
No worries.